from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Voitin.
Happy Thursday, everybody. The sun is outshining outside of the Carter Subaru Studio. It is currently 9:06. I am G. Scott. Mike Lewis is in for Ursula Voitin. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, G.
Good. Chef, good morning, brother.
Good morning.
And Andrew, good morning.
Happy hump day.
My man. Wait a minute.
No. I meant Friday Eve. Sorry.
Oh, okay. You almost threw me off a little bit. We got a big show today. We got a lot of guests. And to be honest with you, I probably don't have time telling you about all the guests that are coming in today. But I have a question for you, and it's this. Do we even pay attention to mass shootings anymore? Yes, that tragic, awful shooting that happened in Milwaukee yesterday. Today at 9:30. We'll speak to a gun rights lawyer from Texas on the latest shooting at Molson Coors. He'll share active shooter strategy and his thoughts on the best way to prevent these strategies. But right now, let's get to the news. Well, starting yesterday, we here on the G and Ursula Show, we just kind of been talking about the coronavirus. It's been a conversation, but now it's really a conversation, especially when you look at the news and you see what's happened over there at Bothell High School, considering that it has been shut down. Bothell High School received their parents received a letter late last night from North Shore District Superintendent Michelle Reed, and in that it talked about how the fact that the school is going to be shut down, and here's the reason why. They had a school staff member that had returned to work on Monday after a week of international travel. Well, a family member traveling with them became sick on Tuesday, and so this is why they decided to close the school. So when you start looking up there, Mike, and you see that Bothell School is closed, even though there is not, it's not a confirmation of the coronavirus, only that a member of the traveling party became ill after that trip, they're just taking precautions.
Yeah, it makes some sense. I mean, they'll get a little bit of criticism for this. Imagine the criticism if it did turn out that unlikely event that it is coronavirus and they didn't do anything and they knew about it. This is going to happen a few more times before this all blows through, if it blows through. I mean, the concern now is that it's leveled off in China, but it's ramping up here in the United States. We had a big case in Sacramento just yesterday with somebody, a person-to-person transmission, and they don't know the origin. In every other case that's happened in the United States, they've known it was someone in Southern California. It was someone whose family member had traveled back from Wuhan, where the virus allegedly is started. This one is a mystery, and this is the type of, and when they get mysteries, particularly when they're dealing with the spread of infectious disease, that's when they get really concerned.
Now, Mike, the Department of Health indicates the risk to students and staff is minimal, and they do not believe the current situation warrants a closing there at Bothell High School. Yesterday, we had on Dr. Peter Rabinowitz, and with him, he said he's the director of University of Washington Center for Pandemic Preparedness. He says, look, he's worried a doctor who prepares for pandemics. Scale of 1 to 10 for you, your, I don't want to say worry meter, concern meter for the coronavirus. Scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the highest. Where would your meter be, sir?
I'd say 7 or 8 that we need to, if we don't take some preparations right now and it gets worse, we're going to really feel like we missed the boat. We need to be concerned. We need to be worried, and we need to be doing some preparations so that if it does get worse, we're ready.
And he goes in, Mike, one more thing as to why he is worried.
Because outside of China, it's not slowing down. It's actually accelerating, and it's jumping to some other countries that are not well positioned to control it well. And it's acting in ways that make it difficult to control, just like the possibility that some people who don't have very many symptoms may be able to transmit the disease. And it is more deadly than the flu, as far as we know right now. So it's combining some things of being very transmissible and pretty bad as a cause of being really sick or dying. There are certainly lots of potential scenarios where we could be dealing with situations very similar to Italy or South Korea.
The it's for people who don't understand the difference in the math when you deal with the flu virus and coronavirus, it's this. Yes, for the people who are saying, wow, we should be much more worried about the flu. It kills, you know, it's killed, I think, 3,000 people in the United States.
10,000 since October. 10,000 since October.
This year, I was going to say.
Year.
I'm sorry.
Oh, this year. Okay. I'm sorry.
So that's a problem. Here's the difference in the math. The flu virus kills 0.1% of people who are infected. The coronavirus kills 2%. That's 20 times more. So if you want a rough approximation of what that means from a math standpoint, about 650,000 people a year internationally die from the flu. This would mean, roughly speaking, like in the 8 million people a year would die from coronavirus if it spread to the same extent as the flu. That's what we're talking about. And this is why if you feel like it's a bit of an overreaction, it actually isn't, because the fatality rate is so much higher with this particular virus that this is why people are not making the direct comparison to the flu. Yes, the flu is killing more people right now. We should be much better about getting our vaccinations, doing the precautionary measures. But coronavirus is the flu times 20.
And hearing Hannah Scott was just in here, and she gave the news about, they said that Gonzaga is asking all of their students over there from Italy to come back. I believe they have 167 students over there studying abroad. And we asked, because there was a listener that asked the doctor about Italy and about if the U.S. becomes like Italy. Have you seen what's going on in Italy right now? And here's what he had to say.
My parents are planning a trip to Italy in about a month. Would you travel there even at this point?
It's an individual judgment. I think that you have
Sounds
to decide
like no.
how much. I would not myself be planning to go to the affected area of Italy unless I had a very important reason to do it.
Mike, I've noticed that when we have on experts to have these conversations, it seems like there's two people talking. There's one person talking like, I don't want to alert everybody. I don't want to cause any panic or anything. And then there's the other talking about, well, what would you do personally in your household? And like you ask him, sounds like you wouldn't be going. And you got that answer out of him.
Yeah. I mean, and I understand that. I mean, you're wearing two hats.
Yeah.
You're worried about your own family and you're worried about your job. And your job is not to spread panic before panic is appropriate. And that's what he's trying to do. And remember, he's also a pandemic guy. So he knows so much about the spread of these sort of diseases and the vectors that move these things from one country to another and then within a country. It makes some sense that he's saying that. But I don't know. For me, it's always a real basic question to ask an expert, like, what are you doing? Why are you not shaking hands with people now? Those sort of things that prevent the spread of a disease.
President Trump was asked last night about how the coronavirus could spread here in the United States.
CDC said yesterday that they believe it's inevitable that the virus will spread in the United States, and it's not a question of if, but when. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I don't think it's inevitable. It probably will. It possibly will. It could be at a very small level, or it could be at a larger level. Whatever happens, we're totally prepared.
20 years ago, Mike Lewis, 20 years ago, Mike Pence said, time for a quick reality check. Despite the hysteria from the political class and the media, smoking doesn't kill. In fact, 2 out of 3 smokers does not die from a smoking-related illness, and 9 out of 10 smokers do not contract lung cancer. And so President Trump, as we know, has decided to, I don't want to say dump or give the responsibility to Vice President Mike Pence on what's going on. And here's what Pence had to say about the coronavirus.
As a former governor from the state where the first MERS case emerged in 2014, I know full well the importance of presidential leadership, the importance of administration leadership, and the vital role of partnerships of state and local governments and health authorities in responding to the potential threat of dangerous infectious diseases.
I have an unpopular opinion. I have confidence in Vice President Mike Pence. Mike Lewis, tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, weirdly enough, I was actually trying to think of why you'd be wrong, but let me tell you why you might be right. So Mike Pence had an opinion about cigarettes that was, you could argue, maybe perhaps influenced by the amount of tobacco donations he got. Given that the coronavirus itself has not donated to his campaign, my guess is that Mike Pence may actually be the guy. You could be entirely right. Now, when the coronavirus starts making political donations, that's when we need to be a little bit more worried about Mike Pence.
Let's get
fair
to,
enough.
Let's get to the headlines, man. We got to do headlines. Let's get it now.
I want to be in the headline. Anything to be in the headline.
First up here, the FBI has arrested four violent extremists after threatening posters were sent to minorities in the Seattle area. And Chris Ingles at King 5 TV, who will join us at 10 o'clock a.m.
I first learned about this story actually reading a tweet in which Chris Ingles talked about that. And I'm glad to have Chris Ingles from King 5. He's going to join us here at 10 a.m. to talk about this. Now people are listening. Hate crimes and hate groups are on the rise. And one of the things that Mike and I talked about yesterday is it the fact that they're on the rise or is it the fact that we recognize them a little bit more? Either way, they're here. This is extremely scary.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, this is actually weirdly comforting that nothing what happened here was a propaganda attack, not a personal attack. And the FBI was on top of it. I mean, anytime you see that happening, that means and it sends a message around the country. They're watching you. And I think that that is actually weirdly something that I'm happy about because we hit a point at the federal level where we had literally one person in the Department of Justice who was watching white supremacists. This was about 4 years ago. Now they've actually decided to take it fairly seriously.
All right. Next up, Bellevue College is apologizing after administrators censored a mural commemorating Japanese internment by whiting out a representation of historic, factual, anti-Japanese agitation by Bellevue businessmen.
Well, this is one of those things you have no choice but to accept the apology when it happens. It's one, and also, sometimes, you know what they say, is better to ask for it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission right up front. That's kind of seems to what happens.
Yeah, this one's a little fishier than that. It's going to be interesting when someone files a Freedom of Information Act request and looks at the communication to the administrators at Bellevue College, because there is not an indication, but certainly the person who was a part of the process, the part of the campaign to push for internment is actually the person who developed Bellevue Square and whose son now. Tightly politically active in Bellevue. There may have been someone reacting to some complaint about having their own relative, I think, judged fairly by history.
Just say no.
I tell him to take a hike.
Russell Wilson has weighed in on the new NFL collective bargaining agreement with a hard no.
I was, first of all, for the first Russell Wilson, I was so excited to see you take a hard stance on this topic and he and other players. And here's why they're saying no. And what he's saying no to is, I don't know if you guys have seen right now, there's a new deal on the table to kind of help further along this new CBA. And it is a 17-game season. It's only a 3-game preseason, a 17-game season in regular season, as opposed to the 16 games. And they're saying no. Here's why. They are putting safety over the amount of money. The money that's coming out doesn't come from the owner's pocket. It comes from us, the fans, when they add the 17th game.
Yeah, remember, pro football contracts are non-guaranteed. I think people sometimes don't recognize. They get more money up front, but they do not, if they get cut, they don't get paid. And I think that they would like to. They'd love to go back to the days of guaranteed contracts.
I want to add to that great point, Mike. The average NFL career is 2.7 years.
With increased concerns about the coronavirus, Governor Jay Inslee is stepping into negotiations between nurses at Providence Hospital who say they are underpaid and understaffed.
Well, this is a great time to have the discussion right now with the nurses. We talked about that in about 2 to 3 weeks ago when we had the Sweetest Nurse deal that was going on. I am glad that this conversation is coming back up because I think we know now how important our nurses are, Mike.
Yeah, it's a little late for Inslee's office to finally wake up and get involved. Inslee's office should have been involved a long time ago. This is the complaints by the nurses at Swedish are serious and I think valid. If you've spent any time, and I did, going to the emergency room at Swedish, it's appalling the level of staffing that they have down there sometimes, and that's supposed to be one of the best hospitals in the area.
Just say no.
I tell him to take a hike.
We'll just go ahead and play that again for no reason. Sports gambling is one step closer to becoming law here in Washington.
I very much dislike this. I know that people that are really affected by gambling are those that live paycheck to paycheck. We are already spending an over an amount of money when it comes to homelessness. We're throwing $115 million here, millions here towards the homelessness problem, but we never try to go and get it to where it starts. A situation like this could increase the homeless population, Mike.
Yeah, this is a weird one in that they've decided to remand all of the... If you're going to do it, let a variety of people have access to making money on it. If you're not going to do it, then don't. And maybe the state should stop its lottery as well, because the state actually is happy to fund gambling when it comes to lottery. So, I don't know. I think that they should allow all the card rooms and everyone else, if you're going to do it, commit fully to it and don't just isolate it on one group of people.
Have you ever done any sports gambling before, Mike?
The March Madness tournament, $5 squares in a bar, something
perfect,
like that.
Perfect.
But that's the whole level of it.
Paid family leave in Washington is so popular that state government is having a hard time keeping up with requests.
This paid family leave, I thought it was an amazing idea. I know that now if you work here in the Seattle area, you're kind of paying into it. And I think it is amazing for families to be able to be comfortable to take this time off. The one thing that I never thought about, what about the people that get laid off now this year? We found out about 500 people here locally at Expedia were just laid off. In that 500, I don't know. I'm asking. Do you think that some of the decisions were made like, oh, this person or this person is maybe pregnant right now? I'm not saying that happened. I just wonder.
Yeah, they'd be really, really stepping into it if they made decisions based on that. I don't think we know yet who is going to be laid off at Expedia, and I'm sure they're going to be making decisions. I would hope. I would take it on faith that they are not going to be making decisions based on who is likely to try to take some time off.
Big show going on. A lot of guests is going to be coming in. 10 o'clock, Chris Ingles is going to come in. I don't know if you guys heard about the story. The FBI made arrest on violent extremists after threatening posters sent to minorities, journalists in the Seattle area. Well, one of those journalists is Chris Ingles from King 5, and he's going to join us at 10 o'clock. And here's a question. Do we even pay attention to mass shootings? Yesterday, on your timeline, did you see anybody talking about the mass shooting that happened over in Milwaukee at Molson Coors? Well, we have in a Texas lawyer to talk about that. It's the Gene Ursula Show. Thank you, Mike Lewis, for filling in. It is the Gene Ursula Show. Happy Thursday to everybody. Mike Lewis fills in for Ursula right now. Really appreciate him for doing that. Question, is a traditional American family under attack? If you think yes, then let us know. How concerned are you about what's happening in Utah? We'll explain how Utah is legally changing the definition of marriage. Next, yesterday, another mass shooting unfortunately took place in America. This time in Milwaukee, where an employee of a Molson Coors brewing company stormed into a company's property, opened fire, killing 5 people, and then shot himself. So, where do we go from here? Again, turn to firearms legislation to protect us? Right now, Washington state legislatures are trying to pass legislation that would all kinds of things. Should we
limit magazine size, things like that?
Right.
Yeah.
Should we instead make active shooter training a mandatory part of our new employee orientation at every company in America alongside sexual harassment protocols? Joining us right now is Edwin Walker, partner in the Houston law firm Walker & Taylor. Mr. Taylor is a proud gun owner, Second Amendment advocate, and a creator of Run, Hide, Fight, Survive and Active Shooter Training Classes. Edwin Walker, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Okay, well, we had another, unfortunately, mass shooting that happened over in Milwaukee. I really hate that happened. But question for you is this. Have we reached a point in America where it's no longer even, ever to talk too soon about this complex issue?
Well, I think that there's it's certainly more nuanced than just saying it's another mass shooting. First of all, a mass shooting obviously implies that there was some sort of randomness about it, that there was some sort of that there wasn't a particular motivation behind it, in which this really is different. Even though there were obviously several people involved, and I think the official definition, I'm using my air quotes, of mass shooter is that more than two people are shot or something like that, which seems kind of an arbitrary definition. I think you have to look at further than that. But this was clearly, we have yet to have multiple details about this, but this clearly was a disgruntled worker who had a problem with the specific individuals that he shot, because he didn't, apparently he bypassed a lot of different employees on his way to this particular spot where he was going. And so, this clearly was the ultimate tragic result of some sort of conflict and discord in his life in particular against these particular individuals.
So
a lot of your traditional narratives about it being an act of gun violence or a mass shooting doesn't really fit into this particular situation. It's a guy who clearly had severe mental and criminal issues. I mean, he had decided that, number one, he was going to die himself, which is kind of the ultimate decision we all have to make. He was going to die himself, and unfortunately, he had such a hatred towards these individuals that he killed that he was going to take them with him. And it's unfortunate. It's evil. It's criminal. Words cannot describe how his motivation and action should be condemned. But in an effort to tie this to some sort of overbroad gun philosophy, I think would just be wrong.
So what sort of mass shooting then can you tie to an overall gun philosophy since you don't think this one should be?
Well, like I said, I don't think this one should be. I think that whenever you talk about a mass shooting, you talk about the random kind of shooting, the ones that happen, the El Paso shooting at Walmart, where basically anybody can be a victim. I mean, that's the kind that everybody is terrified of. And I think you have to look at the mental issue, and instead of looking at what types of guns are available, you look at who or why this person individual actually accessed the firearm, which we've got tons of legislation, both on the federal and state level, that specifically regulate who can acquire firearms. There are 9 different categories of excluded individuals who are not allowed to possess firearms, and they're not allowed to acquire. They're not allowed to purchase firearms under both federal and state law. So I think that's where you need to look, is if you want to address violent individuals, you address who can acquire the firearms, not specifically what firearms can be acquired, because there you're really not, your primary achievement is, of course, limiting the ability of the law-abiding citizen to acquire firearms. And we know that these individuals who use firearms to commit crimes are a fraction of 1% of the individuals who own firearms, the individuals in America who own firearms.
That is the voice of Edwin Walker. He's a gun rights lawyer, and we have him on in response to the Molson Coors shooting that happened, unfortunately, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, yesterday. You mentioned you were talking about the shooter in this situation, and you were saying that you said that this individual had a plan to, I mean, obviously he did take his own life, but was there a reason why you made the comment that you knew that he was going to, or he had planned to take his own life? Is there a reason you said that?
Well, it's an educated guess at this point. Obviously, the police department are very closed with the number of facts they're releasing, but with the facts that are out there, the fact that he was an employee, so he was not an unknown individual, that he went into a confined space, that being the factory itself, and that he targeted these specific individuals, and that he walked past individuals that he knew, so that he was going to be readily identifiable. This is clearly not somebody. I think logic would dictate that this was not somebody who had intended to escape or, you know, quote unquote, get away with it. The way he carried this out, I think that it's a safe assumption that he knew he was probably not walking out of there alive, either by his own hand or by the hand of the police.
So when we look at this, and you earlier said, you know, I think you were alluding to red flag laws potentially, or just better screening of people who legally purchase weapons. Now, we don't know. There's a whole lot we don't know. We don't know the type of weapon. We don't know how he got a hold of it, things like that. Do you think that there should be some advance mental health screening prior to someone purchasing a weapon?
Well, yeah, I think the type of firearm involved is completely immaterial to this situation.
I agree.
And so with regard, there are already those, you know, we already have those screening processes in place.
Back up. Stop for just a moment. Yeah. So where is it that if I went to go purchase a firearm, where would the mental health screening happen unless I already had something in my background? Could you explain that?
Well, you would have to have something in your background already. You would
right. This is what I mean. So prior to purchase, mm-hmm. are you in favor of people getting mental health screening prior to purchasing a weapon?
No, because I think that that's entirely too subjective, and it does not contain any elements of due process.
So
keep in mind, we're not dealing with the government's permission to buy a weapon. We're dealing with the fact that the government has dictated that certain individuals cannot buy a weapon. And so we do not have to go through a pre-approval process to purchase a weapon. You know, we are given the right as Americans, the fact that in America, we base all our laws off the fact that I can do anything I want to do until the government tells me I can't do it. I do not have to have the government's permission to do anything with regard to what I buy, what I use, what I make, what I say, nothing. We don't live in a society where the law says this is a category of stuff you're allowed to do. We do the converse of that. These are things you're not allowed to do. You can do anything else you want. You just simply cannot do this category of stuff. And so we should not have a society that pre-approves people to buy a weapon. We have a society where the government says these are the individuals who can't participate because of something they've done in their past.
Edwin Walker is a Houston attorney who teaches a class also called Run, Hide, Fight. And again, he happens to be a lawyer down there in Texas. And before we let you go, again, Edwin, thank you so much for joining our show. I want to lead with this, and this is the last question for you. What is one thing that we all can agree on policy-wise to make our country a safer place?
I think the elimination of gun-free zones. I think that if you look, I think the statistics say something like 90-95% of shootings take place in gun-free zones, which this, you know, this Coors factory, according to the Molson Coors website, this campus, this place, was a gun-free zone. And as we saw, gun-free zones didn't keep the perpetrator from carrying a gun. It simply kept the, you know, the law-abiding, the rule-abiding individual from having a gun. And so when the lawbreaker shows up with a gun, what does the law-abider have to defend himself with?
Edwin Walker, thank you so much for joining the show. Enjoy the rest of your day, sir. Really appreciate you jumping on with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Marriage, Utah, the future, the past, all being addressed with one conversation and topic. We do that next. This is the Gian Ursula Show. Mike Lewis is filling in for Ursula. It's the Gian Ursula Show. This hour of the show brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. Mike Lewis is joining us right now at 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock, King 5, Chris Ingles will join the show. And unfortunately, There have been some FBI arrests for violent extremists, and they were threatening minorities, threatening a journalist here in town. And, well, that journalist is Chris Ingalls from King 5. He joins us at 10 o'clock. Mike, got some news.
We do have some news. For those of you who, I guess, are planning on relocating to Utah sometime soon, you're going to get an opportunity to expand your wedding options. Utah State Senate is, I guess, on a 70-3 margin, has approved expanding or legalizing polygamy, polygamy having multiple spouses. This has been something that is deep in Utah history, was in the Mormon church history. The Mormon church then decided that that was no longer something it wanted to be a part of, but there still are sort of these sects that are not officially parts of the church that have been pushing for this. There's quite a few people in Utah who currently live in polygamous households. And initially, I guess, I mean, I don't know that I would consider myself a super traditional guy, but I was thinking, like, well, why would you want to expand polygamy? We've kind of walked away from it. It does create some problems. Then I started thinking, well, I don't know. I guess if everyone's happy in that environment, why would we stand in the way?
Absolutely, Mike. There's a lot of people that are outraged. I cannot believe that they would allow polygamy. Hey, do you want to be a part of a polygamous relationship? No. Then why are you mad about it? That would be my question, though. Did you know 1 in 5 right now? I did some studies on it. 1 in 5 Americans right now have been in a non-monogamous relationship, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you're having these things. It makes them happy. As someone who's been divorced a few times, I've had a hard time managing one wife. You know what I mean?
Much less multiples.
Much less multiples.
Well, and the other thing about this that I think that sometimes what we do is we conflate the illegal cult-like environment that's often associated with polygamy. In other words, the child bride situation, the fact that it's older men marrying a 15-year-old so they can legally then, I guess, have children or whatever in a sister wife sort of situation. Those sort of things, I think, are what we're talking about and still should be regulated away. That's an underage person. But the fact if it's consenting adults, and remember, everyone always thinks of it as one man, multiple wives. This obviously opens the door for one woman, multiple husbands, any sort of combination therein. It doesn't, to me, if everyone is a legal adult and everyone is consenting and they want to live like this for whatever reason, you know, maybe the government should get out of the way and let them do it. I think it does create a lot of problems, but nonetheless, I think it should be people's right to do that in the same way I've always advocated for gay marriage as well. I mean, the government maybe should get out of the business of deciding who should marry whom as long as they are legal and consenting adults.
I think the conversations like these, that we're having in 20, 30, 50 years as more women now are in the workplace, you got to understand a lot of these talks that we're having right now, these conversations were had before when women didn't have rights, you didn't have the right to vote, you weren't going out and working for yourselves. Talking about this in 2020 is different than talking about this in 1920, when the traditional roles of women were different. And it kind of brings to a different time.
Absolutely. And also, remember, a lot of the polygamy, the ideas behind polygamy date back into the Old Testament and beyond that. Although, it must be said, in the Old Testament, it frequently was men, including Moses, with multiple wives. The Bible was nowhere near as forgiving with women who had multiple husbands.
Weird.
Weird, right?
Gene Ursula Show.